Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Last evening, public safety forum for the two mayoral finalists at UIC. So BLM Brandon and PHAT Paul were present. And, the takeaways are something that you've heard before if you've been paying any even passing attention to the mayor's race. Paul Vallis on the attrition among Chicago police officers.
Let me ask you about the negativity.
Not sure what that is.
Let me ask you about the negativity.
Okay. Well, that's not Paul Vallis, but he basically had the same thing to say. You know, the 1,000 cops were lost last year, left the job, and normally that attrition is about 330. So it was 3X last year, and this is the way we get cops back and back on beats and CTA platforms and so on and so forth. Let's see if we have any better luck with what BLM Brandon had to say in response to the conversation about public safety.
Why are we describing policing as a community effort only in black and brown communities? How about you just love people enough and be prepared and willing to do your job, and you don't have to have an extra sort of dynamic attached to the dynamic of policing?
Race card.
Total race. 100% race card.
Of course the race card.
I'm so sick of him. You think he's going to embrace Republicans in the city of Chicago? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Well, is that on the table?
No, but he said he's...
embracing Republicans?
Dan, he said he's a mayor for all of Chicago.
Oh, yeah,
and aren't we part of Chicago?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. It's so cute. So sweet.
BLM Brandon also addressed the accusation that he's a police defunder, saying that he was describing a political goal that some people have.
But not his goal?
He supports those some people, but somehow it doesn't redound to him. Okay, well, that's a nice little two-step. He basically said, you know, why can't we just love each other? And it's a great question. Why, you know, is Rodney King-esque, why can't we all just get along? It's a wonderful sentiment, but it's what he's doing. You know, look, I'm a nice guy. You don't have to be afraid of my policies. You don't have to think about the consequences. I just, I'm a pro-love candidate. Oh, I'm a get-along kind of dude. I
mean, there are people who want to see the police budget defunded.
Are you one of them?
Listen to what I'm saying.
Give me an
opportunity to answer the question.
Okay.
I said it was a political goal. I never said it was mine.
Wasn't me. Like that song, Shaggy.
I was just standing next to all those people whose political goal it is to defund police.
Right, because he's backed by people who are defunders of police.
Yeah, sorry to hear PHAT Paul lost the personal PAC endorsement to BLM Brandon yesterday.
Oh.
I guess he's just not pro-abortion enough. He just can't satisfy him. PHAT Paul, I think I mentioned that when he was running his mouth and trying to credentialize himself among the radical left, that you're going to get to the other side of BLM Brandon on these issues. Who are you winning exactly? Mm-hmm. You mentioned something yesterday when we briefly touched on the mayor's race, Amy. We didn't have time to develop it, but you said you felt like there was these are my words, I don't remember exactly what you said, but basically you felt like there was a bit of a stall
Yeah.
Like the momentum for Vallis had stopped. Why do you say that?
It's shifting. I don't know if it has to do with like something as pedestrian as campaign signs, but I just feel like the energy for Brandon here is getting larger and larger and may overtake Paul Vallis.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I wish the election was yesterday, to be honest with you. Then Paul would have locked one, boom, end of story. But I'm so worried the progressives are waking up and they are like, oh, yeah, no, we need Brandon Johnson. That's what we need.
BLM Brandon has pivoted since the primary. Have people noticed? What has Paul Vallis done?
The same old, same old.
Stay the course.
Stay the course, not attacking, not. I mean, he did put out one attack ad finally against Brandon Johnson about defunding police. But besides that, crickets.
Public Safety Forum. I mean, this is his wheelhouse. This is the main theme of his campaign. And what did you hear from him last night? I mean, admittedly, I didn't watch the entire forum, but you heard the clips that are being the takeaways. I mean, it's the typical Paul takeaways from an event. Here it was.
We've lost 1,000 police officers in the last 2 years. In an average year, we would lose 335 police officers. The right leadership, the right strategy, the right approach will slow the exodus.
What do we want? The exodus slowed. When do we want it? You know,
when
we get around to it. Slowing the exodus of police officers. That's the clip that you want in the news. That's going to inflame the hearts of Chicagoans to come out and vote for paradigm shift. You know, it just in these moments, I don't know if he's incapable of it or he just doesn't think it's the right approach. He thinks that being the green eye shades pocket protector dude is enough of a contrast and has enough appeal among enough of the electorate to win. I don't know I'm not sure what it is, but whatever it is, it's lacking in my view. There's just opportunities there to frame the issue. Slowing the exodus of Chicago police officers from the force is not framing the choice before the voters. That's your job as a candidate. What is at stake here? And he describes the trees without ever giving people a view of the forest. You have a city that's disintegrating. You have sort of civilization in Chicago hanging in the balance. And Paul Vallis is navel-gazing, talking about the amount of cops that left last year versus the historical average and leadership and making sort of, you know, generic appeals to leadership and competence. I mean, is this city in crisis or not? Right. I don't mean that Paul should be hysterical running around, you know, the sky is falling, but as soberly frame the race, frame the choice, why this is so important. Why people need to think differently this go around. How precarious Chicago's position is economically, public safety wise, by any measure. And I just don't get that. Well, yeah, I mean, even something
point
like
out
this.
The point out the fact that Brandon Johnson has done zero as a Cook County commissioner, and he's never managed a budget. He's a paid CTU.
You're missing slack. It. It's totally missing it. Frame the choice. It necessarily indicts Brandon Johnson if you frame the choice correctly. And it also perhaps inspires some people to say, I can subscribe to this aspirational vision that Paul Vallis has for the city, if he could ever articulate one, in contrast to the same old hustle that we're hearing from Brandon Johnson. I mean, even something like, use a data point or tell a story that appeals to that larger question. For example, you had a ready-made one yesterday. Listen, folks.
Okay.
We just had the 56th person arrested after being accused of killing or shooting someone and trying to kill or shoot someone while having the previous case pending. 99 people victimized in these crimes last year, 25 dead. A Chicago man charged yesterday with attempted murder for allegedly pursuing a carload of people as his passengers fired on another vehicle, injuring a three-year-old girl.
Oh, stop.
56 person accused of killing or shooting or trying to kill or shoot someone in Chicago last year while having a felony case pending. 99 people hurt, 25 dead. It all was preventable. We have to be serious about taking repeat violent offenders off the streets, and as mayor, I'm going to do that on my side of the house where I can with police. We're going to do it. And then we're going to put pressure on Kim Fox and Tim Evans to make sure these individuals are properly prosecuted and put away for a long time, because we cannot restore Chicago to a peaceful, prosperous place if we can't accomplish this simple task. That you know, don't make appeals to leadership. Provide moral leadership through your rhetorical offerings at a forum like that. Make sure it gets into the news cycle so people hear it and they think Paul Vallis is more than a bean counter.
I feel like he has no spine lately, and that's
he just doesn't get it. He's lost because he's trying to play whack-a-mole with insular constituencies by positioning and repositioning and posturing, and there's no unifying vision for a Paul Vallis mayorship. He's not even offering one. Frame the big question. What is the big question that we have to ask ourselves, Paul, when we start going to the polls next week, when we show up on April 4th? What is the big question that should be in our mind, such that when we answer it in the affirmative, we say that means Paul Vallis for mayor? Tell me what it is. Any Paul Vallis supporter, tell me what it is, because I have no idea.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
So we were talking about the mayor's race a bit, flying off of that public safety forum at UIC last night. And I'm happy to move on and talk about banks if nobody wants to talk about Paul Vallis.
No. Paul Vallis has a new ad that I want you to hear, and I want you to see if this is effective, if this is going to move the needle. Are you ready?
President Bill Clinton called on the nation to follow what Paul Vallis accomplished as head of Chicago schools.
Just look at Chicago, which ended social promotion and made summer school mandatory for those who don't master the basics. Math and reading scores are up 3 years running with some of the biggest gains in some of the poorest neighborhoods. It will work, and we should do it.
As mayor, Paul Vallis will do it again for all of Chicago.
Oh, God. I mean, it's just...
summer school for everybody. If you're failing during the year, you have to go to summer school. Huh? I'm just asking you, Dan, if that makes sense.
Give me your opinion.
Well, I think that when he was CEO of CPS, that's what they did, and it worked well. And I think that I get jittery and nervous every time I see a gym that's not being used or a classroom that's not being used. So I think, yes, that'll work. But nobody cares about that. People care about crime, and he's not pushing it home.
I mean, I'd love to hear from Vallis supporters, since, you know, I'm any criticism of Paul Vallis is like, oh, you stop beating on Paul Vallis, stop trashing Paul Vallis. No, actually, I'm trashing him for being perfidious, as he has been throughout this campaign, to his political detriment. I'm sorry that people don't see that. If you think that what he is offering will get him across the finish line, then fine, make your case. I don't think it will, and I've explained why. He just doesn't get it. If you think that framing a big question, making a sort of larger appeal in terms of the stakes in this race, if you think that's irrelevant, then okay, then you got exactly the kind of campaign you think is going to be a winning campaign. Paul Vallis must think the same thing. I don't think that. And I don't think the Joyce Kenner ad from Kenwood.
Oh, can I hear that?
Or from Whitney Young. Joyce Kenner was.
Yeah, she was Whitney Young.
Whitney Young. Yep. The principal there. The look at our future in the rearview mirror ad with Bill Clinton talking about what Chicago was 30 years ago. It misses the mark. It's not that those ads are going to do him harm, but it doesn't do him much good either.
Got a text message. Vallis sounds like Paul Ryan with his charts and graphs.
What did I say about the Joyce Kenner ad? What did I suggest a couple of weeks ago? So for you're trashing Paul Vallis. No, I'm suggesting what he should be doing, what I would be doing if I was running his campaign or trying to get buy-in if I was. Experts. You've learned nothing. You've not tested the audience. Experts. He's at the elite level. Oh, it's this principal says and that president said 30 years ago. You know what I want to hear? You know what would have some emotional quotient? I'm just repeating myself. Is if it was Mr. Davis from the Austin neighborhood speaking to camera, telling the story about his son and about something that Paul Vallis did at CPS that provided a pathway to opportunity for his son. And his son was in a precarious position. There were bad influences around him. And because of the approach that was taken and the pathway he provided to a particular school where he got particular mentorship from particular teachers, now my son, Mr. Davis's son, is got his BA in engineering, and he's working at a big firm, and he's about to get married. Tell me a success.
You want a testimonial. Right.
I want success stories. I want how policy and Paul Vallis policy decisions as an executive changed people's lives for the better. He always talks about these in vague generalities, and he talks about them from a balance sheet perspective. And by the way, that's not exactly completely accurate. I could go chapter and verse on him skipping pension payments with Richie Daley, but I won't, because that's not the larger point. The larger point is there is no humanity to his campaign. There is nothing to grab onto. There's nothing to be inspired by. You're supposed to be captivated by his idiosyncratic knowledge of the number of police officers on the force and the ward and the police district maps and, you know, this arcane aspect of the budgetary process. You're running for mayor. It's an executive position. It's a vision position. What is the vision? What is the big idea? What is the big choice? You have a city that is disintegrating in front of everyone's very eyes, and you're sort of skipping along talking about how, you know, you make assets and liabilities even. I mean, it's just you're missing the point of this exercise.
I wish the election was today. God, I do.
I don't know how else to say it. I don't know how other examples to give. And also, so it's like Brandon Johnson's a do nothing Cook County Commissioner. That's so lame. That's so like conventional.
Well,
currency.
He's never managed a budget.
It doesn't matter.
He's a social progressive flack. He works for the CTU, makes $100,000 a day. He doesn't have to report it.
$100,000 a day.
I'm sorry, $100,000 a year. But he's also Cook County
Commissioner. So what?
Well, he doesn't. What
no
does he
do? No one cares.
What do you do? Well, I care because CTU, they're extortionists. What?
You're not the audience. You're not the audience Paul Vallis needs to reach. And by the way, the audience he needs to reach doesn't think CTU is a criminal enterprise. I do. You do. This is about the messaging to a particular audience of which you need to get X number in order to get to 50% plus one. This isn't about, like, you know, gourding axes that just to make yourself feel better or prostrating yourself before certain constituency groups to try to pander your way to their support, which is what P-Hat Paul has been doing. I mean, just fundamentally, this campaign makes no sense given the numbers in the city, the political landscape on which he is operating. He again, this idea that he can just do the conventional things and say the conventional thing, repeat the conventional lines like he's Richie Daley running in, you know, the late 80s. I mean, what? Come on. This is it's a close race because the city is in such peril. But it is not a close race because of the campaign Paul Vallis has run.
But I'm so sick. I talked to somebody yesterday again who said, oh, he can't win because he's white. Stop saying that, please. I mean, that's the mindset of people. I'm just.
Of course. Welcome to the city of Chicago and racial politics. He's only in the runoff because he's white. And there were eight minority candidates. Yeah. He thinks he's in there. And some ballot supporters think, oh, because he ran this brilliant campaign. No, he didn't.
He was better the second time around than the first time around.
And the competition was worse. Yeah. I mean, it just.
But I do trust him, and I do think if anybody's going to make change to the city, he will. I know you don't agree with me, but if you want safer streets, I mean, he's our only chance. And I really believe that Mayor Lightfoot is not giving him his opposition research. You know, she gave it to Brandon Johnson because she wants Brandon to fail to make her look good because she's selfish.
So what? You want to go on the attack on Lightfoot? That's past post.
She
so what?
Endorse anybody?
It is baffling to me, and it's somewhat baffling to me that so many people don't see this, and how so many people, if this doesn't change in the next 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks, are going to be surprised on April 4th.
And then I'm going to have to move.
Greg in Schaumburg.
Okay, Dan and Amy, first of all, good morning. Here's what he should do. First of all, the media manager should recognize the personality they've got in Paul Vallis and that he's not going to be able to come across the way you want him to do, Dan, right now. But the next question is, how could you get that message that you want, which is 100% accurate, into the marketplace and make it stick? And the way I would recommend that you do it is, first of all, go back to the very basics of communication, and everybody buys based on emotion. You have to elicit and untap the emotion that is pent up within the city of Chicago, and that is fear. The way you do that is you get people one right after another, after another, after another in a spot, and you have them direct camera on, and you say, I'm scared of this, and Paul's going to fix it. You intersperse Paul Vallis is in there affirming what they have to say for about 8 seconds and in order so he gets on the map. But you let other people do the speaking for him because he's not capable of doing it. And that's what I would do if I was a media manager. And just last point, Dan, the Republicans do not know how to do this on any level in the country, any place. They just don't do it. They always are so vanilla or so meaningless, and that's the reason why we don't win dumb races.
Thanks for the call, Greg. Yeah, I mean, I mean, what he's saying about using surrogates, I completely agree. This is a public safety election. The centerpiece of his candidacy is crime. Where's the victim? A crime victim's family speaking on behalf of Paul Vallis.
Right. That's what we need. Or somebody whose loved one was killed, one of the 25 who were killed while somebody was out on electronic monitoring.
Well, that would be a crime victim's family.
We got a great text message. Dan and Amy, Paul looks like Lovie Smith. He has a lead, but playing not to lose instead of to win.
He's never led. I know what the polls say. But you have to put that on the expected election day turnout and how that will break, if it breaks, you know, according to historical trends. He's the underdog in the race from the get-go. On February 29th, he was the underdog in the race when he had, whatever, a 15-point lead, then an 11-point lead, now a 6-point lead, and so on and so forth. I mean, it's just so frustrating. It's frustrating to watch. It's frustrating to listen to. It's amazing for a city and a state that is as political as anywhere in the country outside of the Beltway, how little people of a center-right perspective understand this. It's stunning to me. People are so exasperated and they're so frustrated, and they're, you know, looking at rather dismal choices and saying, well, this provides some hope. Maybe we can claw our way back, that they just won't go second level in terms of analysis to say, is this an approach that gets us across the finish line? Is this an approach that helps me answer the question, what do we win if he wins? Or what do we win when we collectively win? We just don't ask ourselves the right question. We don't apply the right scrutiny. And so, as Greg said, we lose over and over again. I mean, on the Republican Party, that's a whole different kettle of fish. We don't have any infrastructure. We don't have any courage. But I mean, just on the Chicago electorate, just speaking about that and how a candidate like Paul Vallis has to play that electorate. How he has, and by that I mean appeal. What is the pitch? And I don't think the pitch that he's offering right now is enough. I don't think it's near enough. Mike Lakeview.
Yeah, good morning. First of all, Amy is absolutely right. Vallis is stuck in concrete right now. He's become very boring, repetitions. I'm getting tired of hearing it. And Dan, you are 500% right in your analysis of his campaign. But all you have to stop and think about, I mean, Brandon is playing the race card, but I think the race card is going in favor of a white vote. You know, the white guilt for the brown and black people. All you need to know, I mean, this is starting to take shape of the Lightfoot-Preckwinkle battle 4 years ago. All you need to know is that 38% of the people in ultra-lily white North Center voted for Brandon Johnson versus 32 for Vallis. Mm-hmm. Just keep that in mind. Mm-hmm. And it's going to start turning in Lakeview and all the other ones. Brandon Johnson, you know, I forget about it. As far as I'm concerned, he's a terrible not person, but I don't like his politics. But at least the guy is enthusiastic.
Oh no, he sells his message.
Loud voice.
Yep.
You know, he's totally on message, and Paul is a snooze fest right now.
Thanks for the call, Mike.
No, I agree. I mean, Brandon Johnson, I don't agree with anything that he says, but he sells his platform unlike something I haven't seen in a while. On message, on target. But he is a big bully. I mean, I told you what happened after that event at the Hideout. And I just, you know, I'm a Christian man. I'm a son of a pastor. Well, act more Christian-like, okay? My advice to him when you're off camera.
Matt Mount Greenwood.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I think if a candidate was colored green, as long as they were solid and honest as could be, We'd have a choice, but right now, Vallis, like you, Amy, have the option to move. And Dan, to your point, many of us are just so utterly frustrated. We've been fighting a good fight, and like you said last week, some of us live in this bucket or that bucket. But the fact of the matter is, we've been fighting, and if Johnson wins, we're gone.
We're dead.
I mean, that's it.
And
Vallis
over.
Is a bore. He's a total bore. I mean, he's a turncoat. He's spineless. I can't stand the man, but he's not a communist like Johnson is.
Right.
Have a good day.
Thanks for the comment.
Well, if Brandon Johnson wins, CTU is going to run this show, folks.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what they want.
CTU has been running the show for a long time. This just in, and so
well, they're officially going to run the show, Dan.
I mean, it's the same deal. That is not enough. And we had to have Matt and Mount Greenwood, somebody like that, say, you know, I can't stand Paul Vallis, but he's not a communist. That is not enough of an appeal either to motivate the kind of turnout you need in places like the 19th Ward to make up for what our friend in Lakeview was saying about the awful vote on the lakefront.
Oh my God, they're so excited to I voted for a black man.
I mean,
it's insufferable because none of them even live here. None of them are in the fight. None of them have. I mean, it's just
on the Paul Vallis, you know, is incapable of delivering the. You know, you can write it for somebody, and Paul is a smart enough guy to be and has, you know, his sort of an own sense of moral indignation about some of the things that are going on. I've had enough personal conversations with him to know he can deliver the line.
Yep.
You got to sell him that the line, these are the lines that need to be delivered, that this is the question that needs to be posed and driven into people's heads over the next 2.5 weeks.
I think he's afraid to, bash Lightfoot because she's a black woman.
Is this bashing Lightfoot?
He's afraid that he doesn't want to upset anybody, but we need a leader. We need a strong leader. Just say it.
How do you not upset? How do you run for any office and not upset anybody? That is not possible.
Well, that's the kind of campaign that they're running. They don't want to step on anyone's toes. Like, let's be nice. Don't be nice. The gloves are off. Fight. Fight for your candidacy, but fight for us, the people who are supporting you.
Roger, Southside.
How are you? This is going to be pretty simple. When you look at your turnouts for wards like up north 41, south 19 or 13, okay, when you've got only 55% of the people coming out to vote, okay, that's telling you something. That's telling you that, okay, whatever whites are good people who do vote or do their civic duty are not getting their children to do it. And here's something you could bank on, because this is something, the money's on the street already. The Pritzker money is on the street, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's a trickle-down effect from Soros. I can't trace it and tell on your
radio show. Well, it doesn't matter. The money for the public sector unions from Pritzker, I mean, it's the same infrastructure. It's the same entities of always doing the same thing they always do and largely getting the same results, which is victory.
All right.
Thanks for the call, Roger. We got to jump. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Storied activist investor Carl Icahn was on CNBC yesterday talking about the failure of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank of New York, talking about corporate governance, talking about inflation. He reacted to some statements that were making the rounds made by Ken Griffin, former Chicago resident.
Oh, you mean the racist who's supporting Paul Vallis?
Former Chicago resident.
Yes.
Oh, is he allowed to support Paul Vallis? He doesn't live in Chicago anymore.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if he's giving him money, but he threw a support behind him. And then Brandon Johnson's campaign, he's a racist.
So Ken
Ridiculous.
Griffin.
Don't vote for Brandon Johnson. Okay. But anywho.
So Ken Griffin was opposed to the bailout of Silicon Valley Bank. Yeah. Capitalism, some win, some lose. That's the way it goes. You make certain bets and you reap the benefits or you pay the costs. And why should people who diversified their accounts such that they were at $250,000 or less at Silicon Valley Bank and thus backed up by FDIC, why should those who managed their money accordingly be penalized and compelled with the rest of us on Main Street to bail out these wealthy Silicon Valley interests via the government and via bank fees to make them whole? That was Ken Griffin's reaction. I agree with that. Here was what Carl Icahn had to say. Didn't have much to say about that specifically, but he did make another point that's important.
I don't, and I'm not going to opine on whether or not you bail out a bank or something like that. But you can't have the country feeling that it doesn't matter if they save. It doesn't matter because they can spend all the money they want. You can do whatever you want because the government will bail you out. You can't. He's right about that. You can't have that. Now, should you bail this bank out? I don't know. That's a part of it. I don't like to opine on things that I'm not really that conversant in. But I do agree that the system is breaking it out. And one of the major reasons, not the only reason, obviously, but one of the major reasons is that you don't have good corporate leadership. So you say, so what? But I'll tell you, so what? If you don't have good corporate leadership in companies, yeah, when the tide is high and things are great, it doesn't matter. And all these guys that run these companies are partying and having a good time and giving themselves bonuses. But their agendas are different than the people who invest with them. You know, they're looking to get their bonuses. And I tell you, I live it.
Yeah, he lives it, and he's made billions of dollars by intervening in corporations that were underperforming and improving their performance, prompting an improvement of their performance. Corporate governance. And so what do we know about Silicon Valley Bank? Well, we knew they spent nearly $75 million on supporting Black Lives Matter and other leftist causes.
$75 million?
We know that they, as he was talking about bonuses, as well as the CEO there, selling millions of dollars of stock a couple of weeks before the collapse.
Yeah, that's what
aligned with their shareholders, aligned with their clients. Signature Bank of New York. It seems to me they fail with Barney Frank as one of their directors, board on the board. Barney Frank. Course, and both banks, you know, full on with the left, die and all that stuff. Also, Signature Bank of New York made a mistake when they
put Barney Frank on the board.
put Weird Al Yankovic as their bank president.
What?
I assume he's their bank president because I don't know who is producing these parody songs and comedy sketches. Signature Bank of New York has these well-produced parody songs involving the music videos.
No.
They have music. I mean, that's what they are. They're music videos with their employees and comedy sketches, comedy sketches with their senior leadership. Here's Signature Bank's parody of the group Funds, Some Nights. Take a listen. And you really have to see the video. Just tweeted it out.
All right.
Quite impressive.
Ruthless, so many useless meetings. Some banks will sell their souls. Some banks just feel real old. I wish they weren't so. But I still wake up.
Okay.
I still have the dream. Oh, Lord, I still know what I stand for.
So hard to be. much.
I want to help my clients not be a blight. Stop my bones from wandering. Just how can I? How can I? How can I? Do my best. Come join the bank of best. We will do our rest. We do banking like it should be done. Stand strong, make the change. Forget the past and then you will always win your own.
I am in such cringe mode right now because I'm watching it too while you're while we're playing the audio. And are you kidding me?
I mean,
they didn't pay
stunning.
Any money for actors to do this. They're acting themselves, and they should be at work. And it's stunning, this marketing thing. I mean,
I've offered my services to write, produce, and direct similar videos to Signature Bank here in Chicago. I don't think they're going to take me up on that. I think they're more interested in banking than developing their off-Broadway careers while at the office. But that's not, I mean, there are Signature Bank employees that are now talking and saying it was like the office at the office.
Really?
They spent all this money on and time on producing these elaborate music videos and comedy sketches. That's not the only one. If you don't like fun, how about Katy Perry?
Oh, no.
Their parody
there's
song
more?
Of You're a Firework. No, some clients are letting go. That's for sure.
I mean, who would trust their money in a bank like this? After watching this video, this is ridiculousness.
I got to tell you, some of those bankers have really good voices. Maybe they should think about a Broadway career rather than banking.
Well, they don't have jobs now, right? So they can go into their other.
You don't. You don't like parody songs.
Oh, no.
You're more interested in comedy. Oh, Signature Bank of New York has comedy for you too. Here's a comedy sketch they threw together.
Look, the only way we're going to do this thing is if we start a bank from scratch.
From scratch? You got to be kidding. How in the world do you do that? Is there a book, How to Build a Bank for Dummies?
All we have to do is apply to 19 federal and state banking agencies.
Wouldn't it be easier just to go out and buy a bank?
We looked at that, but the prices are too expensive, and we'd be stuck with all their legacy issues.
So we have to make our own mistakes.
But then we'd have nobody to blame but ourselves. We'd have nobody to blame but ourselves.
Uh-oh.
Well, that is the stupidest thing that I have ever heard. We're sick of the stank of the big major banks, so we'll start one.
It's absurd.
What a terrible proposition. Like convincing the world to eat kale. What possible fate will become of our bank other than to diminish and fail?
You did that.
I happen to know for a fact that won't happen.
Seriously? Why not?
Because
we'll start Signature. Yeah, Signature. Our bank is beneficial as a signature. We'll start off small, but soon we'll sprawl. We'll build a bank that's built to last and to enthrall.
Bones.
Safe loans
and amazing employees.
You have to attest to a place to invest like Signature.
I don't know. Would teams really come out to a bank like that?
We would!
Let's say you've a client to impress, but your bank's pushing something that's stale. Why not move to a place that embraces ideas and lets them prevail?
You can stay with the mega bank where the policies come from above.
Or you can be part of the policies where banking's a labor of love.
You could have crummy systems with all of that drama and pain.
Really good. You know, maybe Mel Brooks will pick these guys up for a remake of The Producers or something. Definitely some Broadway quality here.
They're very talented. I mean, I was in show choir at University of Iowa. Yes, they have show hand. They're very good. But, I mean, did they ever work? Didn't they know that this was a farce, that this was a lie on the American people or the people of New York?
I don't know that this is, all bank employees. I assume there's some higher talent, too. There certainly was higher talent to produce the videos, and I assume to compose the score, the music and the lyrics, particularly that last one.
And
the score
went out on social media?
This is all over the place because, of course, the people inside Signature Bank of New York are very familiar with this. This gets around pretty quickly, and it certainly gets around quickly when you're a $100 billion bank that fails.
Oh my God. And they give $75 million to BLM?
Silicon Valley Bank.
Oh, Silicon, okay.
Ed in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, you know what, Dan? You always say connect the dots. Well, the Democratic Party lost that Friedman guy, or I think that's his name. Even Sean Casten, that scumbag, picked up money from him. So they had to bail out these banks because most of their donors are probably coming from like Silicon Valley and also the depositors of the Signature Bank, which was so painful to hear if you're listening on the phone. So anyway, they're bailing out the Democratic Party by bailing out these banks because that's where their donors are coming from. Have a nice day.
Mary Ellen in Crete.
Hi, you guys.
Hi.
Amy. You took the words right out of my mouth, Amy, earlier. If I knew that my bank was doing what they're doing, I would pull my money.
Immediately.
They're like a Broadway show.
I mean, it's really good. Some of these people have to be hired talent.
I put my bank in there. What?
Some of these people have to be hired talent because, I mean, this is very well produced. This is Hollywood-esque.
That's true. That is true. But this is scary. Very scary. So that's all I wanted to say.
Right.
So you guys
call.
Have a great day.
Thanks for the call, Mary Ellen. And the scariest part about this in addition to just the shock of those videos and their leftist activism and underwriting these banks, the scariest thing, the thing that should be most unnerving and most upsetting is what Charles Payne said the other day and what we've been talking about this week, which is the political ruling class in D.C. lying to you who are listening, saying this is not a taxpayer. There'll be no taxpayer bailout, that, small investors with just small business people, just people that have, regular sized accounts well under $250,000 FDIC cap. You are bailing out venture capitalists in Silicon Valley. That's what it will happen. That is the only way it makes any sense. So what you have is, and we talked about this with Jim Perry yesterday, how big is the bailout going to be? Is it a trillion? Is it half a trillion? We have no idea. But make no mistake, number one, it will be inflationary. It's stimulative. It'll be inflationary. So you're going to get hit there. And bank fees, they're supposedly paying for all this, according to POTUS, you're going to be hit there, the average person with a bank account, you're going to be hit there. You are bailing out regular people play the rules, are bailing out wealthy venture capitalists in Silicon Valley and wealthy operators of tech startups in Silicon Valley. That is what is happening. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Yeah, no doubt on what Charles Payne said. That's all true. But what's also true is that the value of all of the bonds that are out there, the mortgage-backed securities and all the treasury bonds, the $31 trillion in debt that we have, all those bonds, whoever holds them, the value of those are going down as interest rates keep going up. You know, there was some 10-year bonds that traded at a yield of 0.08% back in March of 2020. who wants those today? So if all of those bonds, if some of these banks are even more conservative and they're investing in what were considered conservative investments, the safest investments in the world, treasury bills and treasury bonds, the value of those are all just dropping. So you could argue that the entire system is insolvent, including the Federal Reserve. I mean, how much do they hold in treasury bonds? I don't know how many trillions they hold. It's ridiculous. The whole thing is fake money. That's what happens when you go back to fiat money. It's all fake money. The whole thing's a fraud.
Thanks for the call. Well, and then with a Fed with a printing press, what's that?
But Signature Bank, they had $88 billion in deposits and $110 billion in assets at the end of 2022. So how the heck did this happen?
George in Naperville.
George Bailey is turning in his grave right now. Wonderful life.
Okay, thanks, George. Mike Union.
Hey, Dan, quick question for you. Where's all the bank regulators and the oversight, and who's going to hold them accountable, or are they just part of the scam?
Thanks, Mike. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're
starting
looking for the
tomorrow,
latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. House Oversight Committee Chairman Jim Comer was on with Bill Hemmer on Fox yesterday morning, talking about the news that the House Oversight Committee is getting access to those suspicious activity reports that relate to the Biden Inc. bank dealings. It's not limited to Hunter. The investigation is about Biden Inc., about the family, not just about Hunter. And also that they have heretofore undiscovered wire transfers, including one that took place from Chinese communist interests to the Biden family, including one that took place shortly after Biden was elected, and includes the name of another Biden family member that had heretofore not yet been named. What does this all mean? Jim Comer.
Well, we discovered that they got a $3 million wire 2 months after Joe Biden left office. And then the very next day, from that account, that Walker account that appears to be a pass-through account, then they started wiring money to Biden family members, plural. And there were three different Biden family members that received a cut from that $3 million, including a new Biden family member that's never before been included in any of these investigations. So our question is, you know, what exactly did they do to receive that money? What was the purpose of that $3 million wire? Now, that's just the first wire that we've actually been able to obtain bank records on. There are many, many more.
Okay, you put your finger on it there a second there. Okay, you said, what were they doing in return for that money? Do you have an answer?
I do not. But, you know, the media says, well, this is a Hunter Biden investigation. This is an investigation of Joe Biden. And we're investigating the Biden family. And again, after this new batch of information, it expands. There are more family members involved in this than just the president's son. And what they've said in the media, oh, this was for business. We can't identify any business. It appears it went into their personal accounts. So if China's investing with the Bidens in a business, we can't find any business. They don't manufacture anything. They don't sell anything. They don't own any real estate. We don't know what the business is. You know, my theory is it's influence peddling. And if so, then that's wrong. That's what we call a foreign agent. There are rules with who could be foreign agents, and you have to be registered to be foreign agent. So, you know, the question is, what were the Bidens doing to receive these massive amounts of money from China? Now, we have the first wire, and we've traced it from China to the Biden family members. We have many more to obtain.
Mm-hmm. And he would not name the heretofore unnamed Biden family member at this point. Hemmer got a bit frustrated with him saying, you know, it's been 5 years and what do you got? Well, that's true. And I understand the frustration. But by the same token, it's only been a few months since House Republicans have taken control and have a bit of a new attitude than they did previously about Biden Inc. with all that's been reported and what happened in advance of the 2020 election. and also what we know to be true about the FBI's handling of the investigation and the agent T-Bolt that essentially was sitting on the investigation, and how long did it take for the D.C. press corps to verify the authenticity of the Hunter Biden laptop, for example. So there's been a lot of interference run by agents of the left into any sort of resolution, including law enforcement, unfortunately. So I'll give Jim Comer some patience and see what Hus Oversight does as they're starting to get more documents and making their way through those documents to connect dots and put together a complete picture. But it is interesting. And by the way, so the $3 million wire, just to be clear, because I misspoke.
For what?
Shortly after Biden left office, not shortly after he was elected, shortly after he left office. So this is now dating back to 2015.
Right. And his last trip was to Ukraine, by the way, to take care of that prosecutor who was investigating his son's business.
So, you know, so you're not just going back a couple of years. You're going back, you know, the better part of a decade, and that takes some time as well. For more on this and also that bank bailout business we were discussing, pleased to be joined again by Brian Stile, who, of course, is the congressman just north of the Cheddar Curtain there in Kenosha. Brian, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Just on the Comer Biden Inc. investigation, you know, give us sort of perspective, maybe a little bit of sense of the scuttlebutt within the caucus about how optimistic Republicans are, House Republicans are, about getting somewhere and having some sort of accounting, even if you can't impose accountability on the Biden family?
Well, we need accountability for our entire federal government. And this is what happened under one-party Democratic control, is that we had no accountability. And that's across a whole host of areas. Jim Comer is actually trying to get the facts and allow justice to follow the facts. And so folks over at the Oversight Committee, led by Chairman Comer, are actually just trying to get the facts and then allow justice to follow the facts. We have an opportunity across the board with our federal government to actually bring forward accountability, to make sure that your federal government's behaving in the way that it should, rather than in the way that the Democrats would like it to occur. It's the same reason we have the Church Select Committee led by Mr. Jordan. He's going to be making sure that we're not allowing our federal agencies to drive forward their political agenda. We're doing that in the Financial Services Committee to make sure that woke corporations aren't driving forward an agenda rather than actually making sure people are prepared for their retirements. And so this is the difference between Nancy Pelosi holding the speaker's gavel and conservative Republicans coming in and driving forward accountability.
Well, okay. But, you know, we've and you can understand the cynicism of a lot of conservatives because of what's transpired over the last several years. But, you know, why should conservatives believe that we're going to get anything more than, you know, reports that suggest bad behavior and have negative performance reviews of officials in positions of leadership, maybe all the way up to the president? And then it'll just dissipate into the ether like it has for so many years.
Well, there's no doubt that that's going to always remain a concern. But I can give you an example, something that's off the front page, maybe on the back page. I held a hearing on the committee that I chair, the House Committee on Administration. We held a hearing on the architect of the Capitol. We highlighted exactly how he abused his position. And within 2 days, President Biden fired him, which is an appointment from the president. And so that's a back page story in some ways, but it shows you that we're having real impact. And then we're looking for the big questions, which is where we get the most attention, which is the work that Jim Comer is doing and Jim Jordan is doing.
I wanted to switch gears, talk about the bank bailouts, and that's what they are, bailouts. Let's call them what they are. Speaker McCarthy tweeted yesterday, Biden's reckless spending caused record inflation and rapid interest rate hikes that broke family budgets and banks, too. We must restore fiscal sanity. Okay, but what is the position on bailing out Silicon Valley Bank, bailing out Signature Bank of New York in terms of clients that had more than $250,000, unsecured deposits, essentially? Because this is a taxpayer bailout of these banks, and is the House Republican caucus, are you ready to say what Ken Griffin said, which is Main Street America shouldn't be bailing out wealthy venture capitalists in Silicon Valley.
So the Federal Reserve stepped in under the authority that they probably do have, declared that these were systemic risks, and stepped in and engaged and protected the depositors, as you just noted. There's going to need to be an after-action report. We're going to need to call before us the Federal Reserve to understand why they behaved in the manner that they did. And was it actually necessary to prevent this from being a contagion into other financial institutions across the country? But you're asking me exactly the right question, which is, did the Federal Reserve make the right decision, or is the Federal Reserve need to be held accountable for their decision-making process? Because you're right, at the end of the day, all people who use the financial system, all Americans, are ultimately going to pay for the fact that a special assessment is going to be used to cover the deposits of these individuals.
Well, it's even more than that. And it's even more than that. And this is where, when Biden is lying, or he just doesn't even understand any of this, I don't know which, but it's the same destination. I mean, Peter Conte Brown, who's a professor at Wharton, talked about the $25 billion Fed lending program. That program commits the Treasury Department to backstopping with public funds banks that don't repay their loans. As Professor Conte Brown said, the Treasury has put itself in a first loss position with money appropriated by the Congress. That's taxpayer money. Don't tell me this isn't a taxpayer bailout of these banks.
In many ways, that's accurate, where the federal government is now on the hook. The question here, I think, becomes twofold. One is, did the Federal Reserve have the statutory authority to do what they did without congressional approval? At first blush, it appears that they did. Then the question becomes, did they behave in the best course of action? Because you're correct, ultimately, federal tax dollars are on the line in this situation. The question then becomes, did the Federal Reserve act in a manner where this is the best of bad options presented in front of them? There was no good option. They're all bad options. And they're bad options because we're dealing with massive inflation and higher interest rates. And all of this stems from the reckless spending from the Biden administration under 2 years of Democratic one-party control. They set the inflation fire aflame. The Federal Reserve is raising interest rates to try to tame it. And there's real-world economic consequences for what the Federal Reserve is doing right now.
But do you think more banks are going to fail?
So hopefully, obviously, we all hope that that's not the case. It seems like these banks are pretty unique circumstances where they had very distinct balance sheet risks that were not picked up by their regulators. Were the regulators asleep at the switch? We don't know. But the broader financial system doesn't have the types of risks that these banks did. And most experts will tell you that they're well capitalized and we shouldn't see a further run. But the concern remains, in a situation where we're seeing dramatically increasing interest rates, what's the impact? what's the impact that that's going to have in other areas of our economy? We're still going to continue to struggle until we get inflation under control, which is why we need to dramatically change course on policies in Washington, from inflationary policies of the Biden administration to pro-growth policies to bring costs down so American families aren't footing the bill.
Well, this bailout, I mean, this bailout is stimulative. It's inflationary. I mean, it's just more federal funding money. And, you know, the juxtaposition of this, and I'm not criticizing you, but because you're just sort of characterizing the argument that's been made. But the Fed stepped in because these banks presents a systemic risk. But at the same time, these banks are unique. Their balance sheets were unique, and they don't present a systemic risk, essentially. But we're going to do it anyway. So we're just trying to come up with a cover story for what we want to do anyway. And, you know, and I don't want to bail out Silicon Valley venture capitalists or, you know, crypto speculators. You chose to, you know, have uninsured deposits at Silicon Valley Bank. You know, it's a bad occurrence. I'm not wishing it on anybody, but these are choices that people make. And then everybody runs to the federal government because they want to live in a world where there are no consequences to the mistakes they make, except, you know, on everybody else to socialize the making of whole of the person who made the mistake.
And these are the questions that ultimately we're going to 100% have to ask of the Federal Reserve. One, do they have the power? But two, should they have the power to make these decisions on behalf of the federal government? Or should your elected officials be in a position to actually be held accountable. And we have far too little accountability in Washington, D.C. I look forward to the hearings where we're going to have a chance to actually ask the Federal Reserve why they did what they did, and then take a look. Should the Federal Reserve have this level of authority that they're using in the first place? I think that's the right question to ask.
He is Congressman Brian Stile, rep for Wisconsin's 1st District, right across the border there in Kenosha. Brian, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You've heard our next guest on the program a number of times as we have tracked his good works inside the Chicago public school system and the flack he's taken for the crime of starting a chess club for the kids at Earl STEM Academy in Inglewood at first, before moving over to Ella Flagg Young Elementary School on the west side and starting a chess club there. And by the way, finding success for the students in playing chess in tournaments in Illinois as well as around the country in so doing. So giving opportunities to mainly minority kids in minority neighborhoods like Inglewood or Austin to experience chess, to experience competition, to improve their critical thinking skills, to have fun, to enjoy school. And he also teaches math, by the way. And for that, he has been ridiculed and punished to the extent possible by the Chicago Teachers Union because he's not a teachers union guy, because he withdrew from the union. And so his colleagues are much less charitable to him than he is to his students. He's Joseph Okal, and he joins us now. Joe, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Don. Good morning, Amy. Good morning, Chicago. Thank you for giving me the chance to be here.
Yeah, of course. Before we begin, just give us an update. The last time I think we spoke on the air, you were dealing with some personal health issues too, and we just want to know how you're doing health-wise.
I'm trying to survive, doing my best. I'm inspired by the fact that every day I see my students and they even come, share me coming during lunch break and to play chess. They come before school. They come after school. So I just want them to be productive instead of being in the streets, and productive in a sense that they can also earn United States Chess Federation ratings that can qualify them also to aspire for college scholarship should they continue to play. So instead of being on the streets, and most of them belong to low-income households, and a number of them are in foster care. So I'm just trying to help whatever way I can. And I just feel inspired helping them. And my health, I just feel motivated just to be with them.
All right.
Thank you for
it. But you're doing well? You're okay?
Yeah, I'm trying to survive. I just want to share that last Saturday, our school chess team won second place in the CPS Elementary School Chess Playoff.
Oh, that's awesome.
At Soloriu High School. And there were about 27 schools that made it to the playoff. And my team won second place. And we will advance to the championship March 25th. And we're the only school, I would say, the only level 3 school. The rest are level 1 schools. We will be competing then against 5 other schools: Whitney Young, Skinner North, Decatur, Lane Tech.
Wow, and those are big names.
Yeah, I'm just happy that the kids were able to make it. And also last month, we were the only school that made it to the state chess tournament. And the kids tied 10th place with 10th place out of 60 schools. So I'm just happy that they're able to see themselves as being able to aspire for this kind of endeavor. Yet I'm just sad also that my students continue to face challenges born out of hatred towards me, and perhaps also by the fact that they're African-American kids. So I saw this last Saturday.
Yeah, describe what's happening here.
Last Saturday, while we were in the tournament, one of the coaches, well, she was aspiring that they'll be able to make it also to the top six. She took pictures of the kids who were playing by themselves. They were just playing. After a game, they get the chance to play out of, you know, get out of their seats just to play. But even my co-chaperone noticed that she was targeting my kids, our students. And there were other kids who were playing. There were other kids even playing ball. She didn't take pictures. And the fact that it was intended, her intention was to demean and to degrade them. And I just felt insulted by it, the fact that she said, are these the kids you're going to represent? They're going to represent going to Washington, D.C.? Because there's a tournament end of this month to Washington, D.C. And I found out that her team's going and my team's not going. So despite the fact that my kids were even the ones who represented Chicago last month in the state. So it all boils down to the fact that there seems some hatred by diehard union members. They just could not move on.
Well, so I just want to understand this. So this is a coach of another school's team that was taking pictures of your kids and suggesting that they were misbehaving, and then use those pictures against your kids and your team to prevent them from being sent to D.C. for a tournament?
Yes. Yes,
what was the school?
She happened to be a union member.
Who is she? What was the school?
From Kensey. Actually, we beat her. Her team. Her team came third place. We came second place. And my point is that we should just have fun there for the kids. Should not use the kids. You know, if she has some hatred against me, it should not be taken on the kids.
Well, what did she do with these pictures?
Well, she showed them to others, and she showed them. And that's the point. When we tried to bring it up to her, that there were security people there. They did not complain. There was nothing, and there were other officials there. And she was the only one making an issue out of this. And I found out that she was she's with the union, and she's after me. That was not the first time she did that. She did that before, sometime in 2016 when we won. And I crossed the picket line, and she continues to hound me. And I just feel that, you know, if one hates me, just don't take it on my students.
So I'm trying to do
something for them.
This is what you've been subjected to since you became public about leaving the union, crossing the picket line when there was a strike, because you want to be in the classroom, you want to be with your kids and teach them chess and compete and all the things that are fun for you as a teacher and fun for them as students. And I remember when we talked to you when you were at Earl Stem, I think the same thing is happening at Ella Flagg, if I'm recalling correctly, where you're sort of ostracized from the teachers' cliques at these schools, right? Because you're not a union member.
Yes. And the thing is, I just feel sad that my students will not be able to go because they have been denied the support. There's supposed to be a support for by a foundation tied with CPS, and I found out that we were not included. And yet we were the ones who represented, my kids were the ones who represented CPS in the state tournament last month. And we beat this school. Why is this school going? And our kids not going.
What's the name of the school?
I don't want to fight them. I don't want to fight them, Dan. I just want to find other ways to be able to get the kids to compete because there's another tournament also next month. That's the middle school national tournament. If ever will not be able to compete in this K-12 tournament this month because it may be too late. I'm just hoping that we can give these kids a chance to shine. Give them the opportunity to shine, and they will shine.
Well, this is,
but do
this
not
is,
deprive. Is... They're depriving. They're playing dirty tricks on my kids. I mean, on my students, and simply because they maybe out of hatred, and they cannot move on out. You know, so that's my concern right now. So
I know it's this. I mean, it's just a remarkable situation we've talked about now for years. Of course, it doesn't change.
It's
because
not
CPS
stop.
Doesn't change. $10 billion budget. They have so much money, they don't know where to spend it. But there's no money for chess teams in CPS, like the chess team at Ella Flag and the Austin Neighbor.
Well, there's money for certain sports.
It's just so absurd. It is the sort of absurdity that you get with a command control centrally planned system, unfortunately. And the kids are the ones who suffer, like Joe O'Call's kids at Ella Flag. It's very unnerving. And as our listeners know, and many of them know personally because they contributed, we've raised money for this chess team before to go to tournaments. And we'll do so again, despite the fact that CPS has the money and they just can't figure out a way to support a kid's chess team at an elementary school on the west side of the city. I don't know if there's a bigger indictment of CPS than this and the behavior of some of the adults, like the competitor you were describing, Joe. All right, Joe. So
what's next?
We'll see what we can do to help out. I'll talk to you offline about these other tournaments coming up, and we'll see if we can get together and help you and your kids get to these tournaments so they can have that experience.
And know that your kids are lucky to have you. Always never forget that.
Yeah,
okay?
Just continue doing a great job, and I know you're frustrated, but that's good. You've still got the vim and vigor, so that's a good sign. All right?
Yeah. Thank you very much, Amy. Thank you. Thank you, Dan.
All right, Joe. Thanks so much for joining us. Joe O'Call, chess teacher and chess coach and math teacher at Ella Flag Young Elementary on the west side of the city. Thanks, Joe.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
They got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Dan and Amy, this edition of Campus Beat takes us to Palo Alto, Stanford Law School.
Oh, I love Northern California. Wonderful Christian people in there.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Kyle Duncan is a judge on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Judge Duncan was invited to by the Federal Society chapter at Stanford Law to give a talk about, you know, things like the Constitution to the aspiring barristers at Stanford Law. And, this is how it started.
I'd love to answer your question. Can I? Yeah, and to this room, because you're asking to the room as well. Is that okay? Because you are
this
also
is not
talking
your court.
To the room.
You asked for an administrator. She's an administrator.
You just asked for an administrator. I'm here.
You want to do a chamber? You want someone to
get here?
You
want someone to get here?
So you've invited me to speak here, and I'm being heckled nonstop. And I'm just asking for an administrator to sign the
that's an administrator!
You're racism, Michelle. I would like to
know. Racism.
Wait,
respect black women.
If you
respect black women,
yes, you have problem with you wanted to take it. But do you want an echo chamber? What's the issue?
You an echo chamber? What's going on around here?
What's going on is you're out of order. I'm out of order. This whole damn thing is out of order. And insults were being fielded by Judge Duncan. We hate you. Leave and never come back. We hate the Fed students. F them. They don't belong here. There were signs that the those who attended to protest Duncan made, like, Judge Duncan can't find the clit.
Excuse me?
Uh-huh. Stanford
Law. It's
too
early for talk like that.
Fed suck! Exclamation point. Duncan finally became a bit perturbed, and he called those lobbing those rhetorical bon mots juvenile idiots, which of course they were. That's when he asked an administrator to restore order. And here's where it really starts to get interesting. Meet Stanford Law Associate Dean, because you need more than one, for, say it with me, what? Diversity, equity, and inclusion.
The DIE?
The associate dean for DIE. You know, you need a team. You need a DIE team when you're at an institution of such renown as Stanford Law. Tyrion Steinbach is her name.
Common spelling? Yeah.
She came to the podium to address all assembled, and this piggish, horrid, grotesque in the Kafka sense figure offered the following.
I had to write something down because I'm so uncomfortable up here. And I don't say that for sympathy. I just say I'm deeply, deeply uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable because this event is tearing at the fabric of this community that I care about and I'm here to support.
Sit down.
And I don't know, and I have to ask myself, and I'm not a cynic to ask this, is the juice worth the squeeze? Is this worth it?
It's
an aesthetic. But for many people in this law school who work here, who study here, and who live here, your advocacy, your opinions from the bench land as absolute disenfranchisement of their rights and does land. And it impacts directly their people, humans, their families, and their communities. And I'm uncomfortable, and it's uncomfortable to say this to you as a person. It's uncomfortable to say that for many people here, your work has caused harm, has caused harm. And I know that must be uncomfortable to hear. I know that must be. Let me please finish. And I want to give you space to finish your remarks too, Judge Duncan. I'm also uncomfortable because many of the people in the room here I've come to care for. In my role at this university, my job is to create a space of belonging for all people in this institution. And that is hard and messy and not easy, and the answers are not black or white or right or wrong. This is actually part of the creation of belonging. And it doesn't feel comfortable, and it doesn't always feel safe, but there are always places of safety, and there is always an intention from this administration to make sure you all can be in a place where you feel fully you can be here, learn, grow into the amazing advocates and lawyers and leaders that you're going to be.
Go to a place where you feel comfortable, if it's that uncomfortable for you.
If we're not done yet with Ms. Steinbach, but if you were Judge Duncan, being faced with the students that you've heard and that DIE administrator, mm-hmm. What do you do? How do you respond? 312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 646-36-DA, turnkey.protextline, because you don't have to be invited to a federal society by a Federalist Society chapter at a law school to face something akin to what Judge Duncan faced there. And I wonder if people have thought about how they will react. Is there anything you can say? Because if you say anything, you heard what the response was. If you attempt to address the criticisms, then you're just shouted down. This is, you know, how Jordan Peterson came to some attention when he was just relentlessly shouted down such that he just sat in front of the class in a chair while these
people
students
lost their minds.
Yeah, were losing their minds and banging drums if he tried to say anything and so on and so forth. The same sort of screeching and shrieking and hysterics you're getting here. So what do you do if you're Judge Duncan?
I mean, he was there to talk about the Fifth Circuit and the Supreme Court and constitutional law, and then he got that. I mean, he is a conservative, whatever. Who cares? That doesn't mean he should be treated with respect.
So
but why can't they tolerate people? I mean, whether you're moderate Republican or a conservative, they just can't stand it. And I don't know if it's the Trump factor or.
And
but it's
so, what
so
do you do
worse.
About it?
I would have walked out.
What they can't stand is obvious.
Right.
How they're going to behave is obvious. It's they've demonstrated. So then, what is the response? Because again, the Dye administrator, Ms. Steinbach, she continued offering her pro forma defense of free speech. Something else that has been redefined by the left. Okay. Take a listen.
We believe that it is necessary. We believe that the way to address speech that feels abhorrent, that feels harmful, that literally denies the humanity of people, that one way to do that is with more speech and not less, and not to shut you down or censor you or censor the student group that invited you here. That is hard, that is uncomfortable. And that is a policy and a principle that I think is worthy of defending, even in this time, even in this time. And again, I still ask, is the juice worth the squeeze?
What does that mean?
I mean, is it worth the pain that this causes and the division that this causes? You have something so incredible, important to say about Twitter and guns and COVID that is worth this impact on the division of these people who have sat next to each other for years, who are going through what is the battle of law school together so that they can go out into the world and be advocates. And this is the division that's caused. When I say...
Is the juice worth the squeeze? Is it worth the division this is causing? So we're a free speech advocate. Here, we're free speech advocates at Stanford Law, says Ms. Steinbach, and the cure to speech, hateful speech, destructive speech, like, you know, what you have to say, Judge Duncan, is more speech. By the way, stop speaking. Don't speak because the juice isn't worth the squeeze because it's too much. It is too much for Stanford law students to listen to a judicial perspective from a federal appellate court judge on salient constitutional matters of the day because he comes from an originalist perspective. That is too traumatizing. Much. It causes too much division. And Ms. Steinbach is just worried that the bonds that she has forged in this community of Stanford law students are being torn at their seams. I mean,
so the administrator sided with the hecklers, obviously. And I mean, what would you have done if you were him, Dan? Would you have walked out? Would you have demanded order?
So this is the denouement.
Okay. Oh, I had that for dinner last
night. The hyper-political lens, and just look and see human beings who are asking you to take care. And like all guests on our campus, we ask that you come with good intentions and respect. And I do want to hear your remarks. And I do want to say thank you for protecting the free speech that we value here of our speakers and of our protesters. And I want to remind you all of one thing. I chose to be here today. You all chose to be here today for Judge Duncan, who do not necessarily choose to be there. And they have to listen to everything he says. Literally thousands of people. You have a choice. You do not need to stay here. This is not where you want to be.
Oh,
you can stay here.
I can leave? Me?
Right now, but make that choice. If you do choose to stay here, I do think we should give space to hear what Judge Duncan has to say. And I hope that also you will take question and answer and comment section to say what you need to say and to ask the questions you need to ask. I'm really grateful to be in this institution. I look out and I don't ask what is going on here. I look out and I say, I'm glad this is going on here.
Such profound words.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And then about two-thirds of the room filed out, mostly women.
Of course, probably rich.
Kurt in Bolingbrook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, guys. Good morning. Yesterday, the students stood up, about 100 of them lined up outside this lady's office for a silent protest with a couple of the faculty members too. It seems that a lot of the law students weren't the ones protesting. Mm-hmm. So I don't know the exact of it. I was reading it yesterday. I'm sorry, I can't. I should find it, Dan, and attach it to your instant message. But you guys got to look it up and see what happened over there yesterday. Yeah, at least somebody stood up.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Kurt. I did see that. Yeah. Yeah, but there's something, I mean, and that is good to see that there is some cohort of civilized people matriculating at reputedly our best institutions, especially since they're all moving in the direction of the practice of law, for God's sakes. Glenn in Oakbrook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, those law students are teaching censorship and hate, and I would take any money going to Stanford and pull it out immediately.
Thanks for the call, Glenn. Hopefully Tiger Woods was listening. Mike in Northwest Indiana.
Yeah, I'm just curious about the admissions office at Stanford. Are they applying the same type of reasoning? Are they just like Harvard, they're openly not admitting Asians because they're too well-prepared and work too hard to get where they're at, or... just how serious is this? This is wrecking our highest levels of institution. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike. Well, that's the associate dean for DIE. That tells you a lot about the administrative's perspective. Number one, that positions like that exist.
Well, she should get fired.
Number two, that they hire people like her. And she's standard issue.
I mean, get a grip, woman. My God.
Yeah, but you understand that is like, that is median numbskull.
Okay.
When it comes to people in these positions, and frankly, administrators in the academy, generally speaking, median numbskull. Just, you know, basically somebody that would be indistinguishable from, you know, a daytime TV talk show host. Associate dean of, yeah, right. She's an academic. She's a thinker. It's community and this and that and tearing us apart. By listening to an appellate court judge talk about legal reasoning behind opinions he's rendered or in part rendered, I mean, what? At a law school of all places. What would she have said? What would these people think? How does Sotomayor endure Thomas? How does Thomas endure Kagan?
Well, you know, Scalia and RGB were best friends.
They need to go to their safe space. I can't hear words that I disagree with, opinions. And so did Thomas or Sotomayor hold up signs and say, you suck, when
no.
The other one is speaking? What the hell is wrong with people?
Say anything.
This is not even close. Stanford.
This is Stanford.
And we say it about these Ivy League schools where you have these same cohort, perhaps majority, I don't know, of juvenile idiots, as Judge Duncan properly called them.
But you should see the picture of this woman. I mean, she has the heat of 1,000 suns of anger on her face.
Yeah.
As if somebody's robbing her home or stealing her children or trying to kill her. Or stalker.
She is a human zeppelin with a room temperature IQ. And they're everywhere in positions of authority, coddling juvenile idiots. Because she was one 5 minutes ago, too. Corey in Woodlawn.
Hey, morning, Amy. Morning, Dan. The same thing happened to Charlie Kirk in California a couple of days. Those individuals look like the real insurrectionists from January 6th. But the only way to deal with this is to take it. These individuals need to hear an opposing opinion. And if you don't stay there and take it, you won't be able to get your message through. Thanks.
Thanks, Corey. John Oak Park.
Yep, just want to second that. I have an employee that's getting his master's in engineering right now at a UIC. And the garbage they're teaching our engineers to promote in their designs for the ESG or deity crap, it's out of control. But we all should go back to school Roddy Dangerfield style and take back our universities.
Yep.
And show these kids what it is to be an adult out there. I mean, I think that's what it takes. We need to go back to school.
And bring Lou with you, right? Wasn't it a muscle? Wasn't it Lou?
Yeah, the muscle. Moose. Yeah. Moose.
Who's Moose?
Thanks for the call, John. Yeah, when I get mad, he gets angry. Beverly, West Loop.
Hi. I'm a substitute teacher for the past 6 years here in Chicago, and I just wanted to let you listeners know this doesn't begin in law school. In fact, I'm thinking about going back for my master's. I'm in the application process, and I'm really worried because I'm a mature woman who's had an education that taught me how to think and reason and argue, and I'm very worried because today, almost every single Chicago public school, they're very worried about let's find out about your emotions on the emotions chart, or how are you feeling today? Is everything going okay? I got to tell you, Sister Lucilla never once asked me how I was feeling, but she taught me to read, write, and reason.
Thanks for the call, Sister Lucilla, indeed. Thanks for the call, Beverly. All right, well, that's sentimental barbarians raising the next generation of sentimental barbarians. That's what they are. Emphasis on barbarian.
Listen to this, a text message. Megyn Kelly, guys, featured this story last week. The student who invited the judge to speak was offered mental health services after the fact from the woke.
Bob and Wilmette.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. This is just a classic example of what you get when cohorts of students are intellectually breastfed by the leftist teats of academia for decades on end. And it's going to be quite the road to hoe to get that mindset changed over time.
Very useful metaphor. Thanks for the call,
Bob.
It's
just a bunch of delicate little snowflakes.
Jack in Northwest Indiana.
Yes, just wanted to follow up on the comment concerning Stanford Law School. I had read yesterday that the dean of the law school actually reached out and did apologize to the judge. And then what occurs, the students are now requesting that this dean be fired. So interesting turnabout. She does the right thing. And in light of what she said, they are now demanding that she be replaced.
Well, of course. Thanks for the call. Wait, one temper tantrum begets another. I mean, didn't they not make it clear we either get our way or we want to expunge you, silence you? That's the approach. The good news is there's a level of pushback that's occurring. There were some good editorials in the Future View column of the Wall Street Journal today about Dye on campus from students, from a handful of students around the country that were thoughtful and well-reasoned. You had a piece in the New York Post by a woman named Maud Marone, who is leaving the Democrat Party after 33 years because of their pro-censorship position, as mainly exemplified last week during the Twitter Files hearing that we discussed earlier in the week. So there are people even of the sort of the center left. We're going to talk to Alan Dershowitz at the bottom of the 8 o'clock hour. He would be another one that are pushing back against this totalitarianism. But boy, there is a long way to go on that pushback because it is deeply ingrained in all these institutions controlled by the left, which is basically all of the cultural, civic institutions in America. A lot more hands on deck are required, no question about it.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, billionaire activist investor Carl Icahn on CNBC yesterday, talking bank bailouts and corporate governance, as well as reining in inflation. Well, I had this to say about corporate governance, which seems to be a more than pertinent topic given the corporate governance of both Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank of New York, as we're learning more about with each passing hour. Here's Icahn.
Powell really has to raise interest rates sooner or later. I can't talk about next week or even next month, but inflation is the worst thing an economy can have, and I think people underrate that. If you look in history, every hegemony has been destroyed by inflation, or almost everyone. I mean, just go back to Rome. That's what happens. And
one of our major problems, I think, in this economy right now, is there's no leadership on the corporate level. You know, forget politically, and I'm not going to get into politics, but I think you do feel that in Washington, nobody knows what's really going on. But forgetting that, in our corporations, and I've lived with that, I mean, all my life, basically, and companies today really have, with many exceptions, many, many exceptions, leadership is worse than mediocre. And that's why we are so successful. I mean, not because we're geniuses, but because you go into a company today, and that's what we've done over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really horrible what you find in many of them. Just
we'll get to your...
Imagine if Carl Icahn had taken a look at Signature Bank of New York for possible acquisition and found those parody songs and sketch comedy routines that the senior leadership of Signature Bank of New York was busily producing rather than minding the store. Icahn went on to emphasize the need to combat inflation, that because of what's happened with those two big banks does not mean that Powell should take his foot off the interest rate pedal.
Bank failure is a manifestation of the leadership in our companies and the way they spend money. And you really have a moral hazard if you just keep bailing them out. I'm getting, in this case, I'm not going to opine on trying to save some poor people, although the depositors in Silicon Valley weren't exactly poor people. But that's not the issue. The issue is you have to stop inflation. So you say, did we keep going on? I don't think you have a choice. If you don't keep going on, I really believe that the problem of inflation can become such that it's very difficult to get out of it.
For more on this, please be joined by Steve Moore, economist, GovZilla author. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Well, good morning, guys. By the way, you caught me with a donut in my mouth. So
all
that for a second.
Finish your donut and then respond to Carl Icahn.
No, I got to tell you, though, that Carl Icahn clip, amazing. I mean, you don't need me, Dan Amy, because he said it perfectly. We have mediocre leadership at best in Washington. We're borrowing money like crazy. It's driven up interest rates, and it's causing havoc in the banking industry and the financial industry. It's that simple. Week after week after week, we've talked about this. Now, I'd add a couple things. Stop with this nonsense of saying this isn't a bailout, Joe Biden. Of course it's a bailout. Even Paul Krugman today in his column says, okay, yeah, this is a bailout.
Yeah, and right.
Stop with the nonsense that the taxpayers aren't going to pay for this. Damn, Amy, if the taxpayers aren't going to pay for it, who is? The man on the moon?
Will our banking fees go up because of this?
Right.
Well, seriously, am I paying for this?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just so dishonest. And the third thing I've got to say, and you can tell I'm a little angry because I just think this is so wrong. And then you've got, if you go back to the early 1930s when we started the deposit insurance system, it was basically from, lower income and middle income working families so they wouldn't lose their lifetime savings if a bank failed. And, I'm a pretty libertarian person, but I think that was probably a pretty smart policy to stop runs on banks. The number keeps going up and up and up. Do you know what the first number was, by the way, the amount of the limit on the FDIC insurance was back in the 1930s?
No.
$2,500. Now, there's been a lot of inflation since then. But,
right.
Even if adjusting for inflation, that's maybe $100,000. Today, the limit is $250,000.
Right.
You know what the limit is going to be tomorrow?
Unlimited.
Infinity.
Yes.
Infinity. And so this – now, how many people who are not rich do you think have a deposit in banks of more than $250,000? probably pretty close to zero, right?
Right.
And so this is not just a bailout. It's a bailout of rich people. Now, wait a minute, Dan and Amy. I thought last week Joe Biden said he was going to sack it to the rich. I guess he has to tax the rich so he can give the money to other rich people who have money in these accounts. I mean, it is the most crazy lunatic thing. And it just seems like nobody, as Carl Icahn said, there's no adult in the room in Washington.
Well, this is these are the preferred rich, though, because they're leftists exactly, in Silicon Valley. I mean, what do you want? You want Gavin Newsom to lose the funds that he has for his wineries in Silicon Valley Bank, something that he didn't disclose as he was cheerleading the bailout of Silicon Valley and also Silicon Valley Bank, because it's both they're inextricably linked. But where are
by the way, one of my friends just tweeted me this morning and said, you know, if it was Shenandoah National Bank, do you think they would bail them out?
Yeah, right.
Probably not. These are the rich Democratic donors. And,
that's right.
It creates – and, again, Carl Icahn really nailed it. This is a classic moral hazard problem. Dan, if they're going to – every time you make a bad investment and you lose money, they're going to give you your money back, then you and I are going to get the next flight out to Las Vegas and put all our money on the roulette wheel. Because if we win, we made millions of dollars. If we lose, the government's going to give us our money back.
But why do we not hear Republicans saying we're not going to do too big to fail anymore? This is whether the Fed technically has the authority to these emergency measures and so on and so forth. We can argue that, but it is a bad policy decision, whether you have the power legitimately or not, to bail out Silicon Valley and these uninsured depositors, and we shouldn't be doing it. I don't hear moral clarity from the Republicans on this.
Yeah, because I think they like bailouts too.
There you go.
How many times in our lifetime have we bailed out failed companies? I mean, this is the last time, okay? And this is the last time we're going to do this,
right?
It's like, when I was growing up, my mom used to take out, she would take up the switch and she would whack us. If you do that again, I'm going to whack you. But imagine if you had, if my mother said, if you don't empty the dishwasher, I'm going to give you a spanking. But I don't empty the dishwasher, she doesn't spank me. And then she said, but if you don't, empty the dishwasher and spank you, and the next day she doesn't. You can appreciate this as a mother, and so what happens? You don't believe them. Why would anybody believe these people? They always bail out the losers. Mm-hmm. This isn't free market capitalism. Mm-hmm. It's not the free enterprise system. This is the opposite of free enterprise. Will you please tell your Republican friends that, Dan and Amy?
Right. They had 88 billion in deposits, 110 billion in assets at the end of 2022. So this is all blamed on Biden? I mean, what else could it be blamed on?
Well,
besides rising interest rates.
That's a good question. So here's what happened, and I'm not a total expert on this, but basically you had zero interest rates for many years by the Fed. They orchestrated this. And then all of a sudden, we get a president who comes in and he borrows trillions and trillions of dollars. And Trump actually did that in his last year in office during COVID. So we borrowed like $6-7 trillion. And what happens? Oh, gee, we have inflation. Who would have thought that would happen when you borrow all this money and pour it into the economy? And so the inflation goes up to 9%. And the Fed has to raise interest rates to suck some of this money back. So the interest rates went from basically 0% to 4% in less than a year. And these banks made a wrong arbitrage play on the interest rates. They were holding all these bonds that were now worthless because of the higher interest rates. And that's why Silicon Valley Bank went bankrupt. But there's another tangent to this story, which you guys mentioned earlier, which is, isn't it interesting that these banks that are collapsing are the ones that got into all this woke craziness? And when I saw that, was it Signature Bank that had that crazy people dancing
the
around?
The videos,
I mean, I thought, was that a parody or is it real?
No, it's real. They paid a lot of money to produce those videos.
Oh, my God. Folks, if you haven't seen those videos, I mean, my jaw just opened. I mean, how much did they spend on that, Amy? Probably millions of dollars. It's high production.
It is. And then they tried their, hand at comedy and sketch musical combos and... It's so cringeworthy.
And then you have the situation in Silicon Valley Bank. This, Dan, where they basically didn't have anybody doing any due diligence in terms of the risk officer. They for 6 months they didn't have a risk officer at a bank.
And they gave themselves all bonuses at the SVB before they left. The day before that, FDIC took over, they get, you know, because who gets bonuses in the middle of March? Nobody. Only when you know your bank's closing.
Yeah, you know, that sounds a lot like Bernie Madoff. You know, it sounds like let's get our money out of this thing before it completely collapses. So it's a smelly story. It's rancid. We keep bailing out the losers. And who's always the person who pays the price tag for this? The little guy. And when you mentioned, Dan, too big to fail, which is a terrible doctrine that we have. What do we have? Big labor, big government, big business. They're too big to fail. But I guarantee you, Dan, Amy, you and me and all the people listening to this show are not too big to fail. Let the big businesses and big government and big labor, they are too big to fail.
And also, since we don't really know what the ultimate number is going to be, we don't know how many more banks will fail once there's a real taking into account of what their balance sheets look like. It could be in a lot of regional banks could be in the same position with respect to a bond that Silicon Valley Bank was in. So we don't know how big this is ultimately going to get. But to the extent that we're into billions, hundreds of billions, perhaps, of dollars, then isn't that inflationary? So we're going to continue printing and spending while Jay Powell is incrementally increasing interest rates. So we're exacerbating inflation while he's trying to combat inflation. The fiscal side is doing one thing. The monetary side is doing another.
Yeah. None of this makes any sense, folks. These are kindergartners playing money with our, you know, playing games with our money. And yeah, I mean, this all circles back to the spending spree in Washington. We have a government that is completely out of control. They're acting like they're playing with Monopoly money. And this is real money, folks, that they're spending. And you're right, Dan. I want to make sure people understand this, though. We're not facing a mass, you know, I don't want people to be afraid that they're going to lose their money in the banks because they are insured. And so that's a good thing. And so you don't have to worry. You don't have to run to your bank right now and take your money out of the bank. But it just is so obvious that the people who always benefit from these programs are the big political donors, like the people on Silicon Valley. And it wouldn't have happened if it had been Shenandoah National Bank, because people don't care about them. They care about the donors of both parties. And I'm not being Republican here, because the Republicans, it was under George W. Bush, we did the last big bailout. Remember
that,
Dan?
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
And remember, do you remember what George Bush said? Remember his famous quote? And I like George Bush. I mean, remember he said, we have to destroy capitalism to save it, or something
right.
like that.
No, I mean,
right?
it's no different than Joe Biden with the shovel-ready project saying we have to keep spending money to prevent from going bankrupt. I mean, this is the doublespeak that you get from both sides, which is why people have rebelled against the political ruling class and may again in 24. We'll see. He is Steve Moore, economist and Govzilla author. Steve, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Okay, guys. Have a good one. Take care. Bye.
Thanks. You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Matt Taibbi, one of the journalists who's been publishing the Twitter file information over the last several months, and who appeared before that House committee last week, along with Michael Schellenberger and others, FBI whistleblowers like Steve Friend. Matt Taibbi offers a pretty good postmortem on the experience and where the Democrats are right now when it comes to, well, free expression, first and foremost. He writes that he and Schellenberger repeatedly quizzed about money we have made during the Twitter files period, which we played for you, the exchanges between him and Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Texas Congressman Colin Allred told me to take off my tinfoil hat, and that the three FBI agents were accused of conspiratorial social media posts. All Red, the same congressman, blasphemy for criticizing the national security agencies. Grapple with the reality, he said, that the very rights you think they're trying to undermine, they may be trying to protect. They were accused of being stooges for Elon Musk, friend, and the FBI agents were agents of Kash Patel, Trump administration intel official. But Taibbi points out the most outrageous portion of the Democrat Party's report came in a section claiming that because the agents were not really whistleblowers, which is arguable, and therefore really just expressing their opinion, they're not covered by any law. No law protects witnesses who speak to Congress under these circumstances, wrote the Democrats on the committee. Well, as Taibbi points out, actually, the Whistleblower Protection Act specifically protects witnesses, and the First Amendment generally does, but not to the Democrats on this committee. He concludes, the style of the new anti-speech Democrat is clear. Define all government critics as lacking standing to criticize. Impugn their prior opinions and associations. Imply that all their beliefs are conspiracy theories. Define their lack of faith in the FBI's judgment as treasonous and declare their motivation to be financial. Lastly, when they invoke common constitutional rights, make a note that their activities exist in an uncovered carve-out. This is the playbook, and we all better get used to it. Well, we either better get used to it or we better call it out like Taibbi is and push back hard against it. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Professor Alan Dershowitz, Emeritus Professor of Law at Harvard. His podcast, The Dersh Show, can be found on Spotify, YouTube, and iTunes. His latest book, Get Trump, The Threat to Civil Liberties, Due Process, and Our Constitutional Rule of Law, is available now, as is his last book, which was released earlier this year, Guilt by Accusation, The Challenge of Proving Innocence in the Age of Hashtag Me Too. Professor Dershowitz, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
It was really a scene last week at the hearing and watching the treatment by Democrats of Democrats, Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger, who both identify as men of the center left.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have the same problem. I'm a person of the center left. I'm a liberal. I voted Democrat all my life. And they're trying to shut me down, too. The Democrats and the left have lost credibility on issues like freedom of speech and the First Amendment. It's free speech for me, but not for thee. Some of the most repressive comments have come from people on the hard left, the woke culture. We saw what happened at Stanford University the other day when people from the left, the National Lawyers Guild, set out to deliberately prevent a federal judge from speaking. And then the dean of diversity at the law school basically agreed that a person like that judge shouldn't have the right to speak because he may upset some people. And, you know, the First Amendment is just out the window. The American Civil Liberties Union has forgotten about the First Amendment. All it cares about now is defending woke culture. And, you know, I grew up during McCarthyism. I remember how dangerous it is when the government tries to suppress free speech. And it's so important to have an aggressive an approach to fighting back, because without free speech, democracy can't survive. We have to have the information to tell our elected members how to vote and who to vote for. They're our representatives.
Well, when is enough enough and you might leave the Democratic Party?
Well, it depends on who's on the Republican Party. You know, for me, it's always a choice, often a choice of evils, unfortunately. You know, I remember when I was representing President Trump, he would ask me all the time, why aren't you voting for me? Why aren't you voting for Republicans? And I say, look, there are many issues involved. There's a woman's right to choose. There's gay rights. There's the climate. There's so many issues that, you know, we make decisions based on all the issues. On the issue of civil liberties, I am no longer supportive of the Democratic Party. I think they have neglected civil liberties. And if the right Republican were to be nominated and the wrong Democrat were to be nominated, hey, it'd be easy for me to make that switch. I've never voted for a Republican presidential candidate before, but I easily could see it. I made one serious mistake. I voted for Barack Obama the second time. I should have voted for Romney. That was a big mistake. I wish I had voted for Romney. The second term of the Obama administration was an absolute disaster.
Well, speaking of Trump and civil liberties, that's your latest book, Get Trump, The Threat to Civil Liberties, Due Process, and Our Constitutional Rule of Law. and a case that is moving along to some conclusion. We're not sure what conclusion yet, but is in Manhattan, where the DA there, yeah, Alvin Bragg, is trying to put together a case to charge Trump with felonies for improper, yeah, business record keeping and campaign finance violation.
It's a phony thing. I don't want to ever make comparisons to the Soviet Union, but it does remind me of the time that Lavrenty Beria, the head of the KGB, said, "Stalin, show me the man and I'll find you the crime." And, J. Edgar Hoover used to do that. You target people. What happened with both Bragg and the Attorney General of New York, Letitia James, they campaigned on the issue of getting Trump. We'll get Trump. Right. Elect us and we'll get Trump. And then they spent months looking for statutes, looking for something that they can get him on. And they came up with this Mickey Mouse stuff about if he paid hush money. And if he did, that's perfectly legal. And, did he pay back Cohen, who paid the hush money? And does that constitute a campaign contribution? It's so phony. Does anybody believe that Bragg or James would ever go after a different person other than Trump? The Bible has an interesting instruction to judges. It says there are two things judges can't do. One, take bribes. That's obvious. The other one is do not recognize faces. Lo takir panim in the original biblical Hebrew. Don't recognize faces. Don't ever do justice based on who the person is, not what it is they've done. And nobody would dream of going after anybody on this Mickey Mouse campaign contribution thing unless they were out to get Trump. Look, I'm not a Trump supporter. I voted against him twice, and I have a constitutional right to vote against him a third time. And don't let prosecutors deny me that right or deny you the right to vote for him. That should be up to the public, and we shouldn't have bureaucrats and elected officials and DAs determining who can run for office.
Aren't you forever surprised by how Trump is able to bring the illiberal impulses out of the illiberal?
Oh, yeah. Oh, out of the liberal, too. And
yeah, okay.
It's just horrible. I, as you know, I've had friends on Martha's Vineyard like Larry David and Caroline Kennedy, who won't speak to me anymore because I have defended Trump's civil liberties. These are people who claim to be liberals. But if you did anything to defend the Constitution on behalf of Donald Trump, you're no longer acceptable in that milieu. And the worst offenses against civil liberties have now come from Democrats who want to get Trump. And that's why I wrote the book, Get Trump. It's not a pro-Trump book. It doesn't say anything about elections. It's a pro-civil liberties book. And the reason I'm defending Trump is that he's become the source of denial of civil liberties. Civil liberties for me, but not for thee. And that's a very dangerous phenomenon. Today, it's directed against Trump. Tomorrow, it could be directed against you and your relatives. And you can't allow precedents to sit around like loaded weapons, ready to be used by political opponents. The politicization of the criminal justice system is one of the most dangerous phenomena of the 21st century. Sorry.
Are your views about the possible case against him in Fulton County, Georgia, as well as, of course, the special prosecutor investigating him on behalf of the DOJ, are your views on those matters the same?
Exactly. The Georgia case turns on one statement where he says, I have to find 11,000 votes. He said, fine. He didn't say invent. He didn't say make up. He didn't say concoct. He said, fine. There's a dictionary definition of fine. Fine means something that's been lost. It's there. What he was asking for is look around, see if there are uncounted votes. And if there are, find them. That's not the basis for criminally prosecuting a man who's about to run for president. It turns us into a banana republic when we start going after our presidential candidates or anyone else based on vague, ambiguous statements that would never serve as the basis for a criminal prosecution against somebody who is not a political opponent. So, yeah.
He is Emeritus Professor of Law at Harvard, Alan Dershowitz. His podcast, The Dersh Show, can be found on Spotify, YouTube, iTunes, The new book, as we were discussing, Get Trump, The Threat to Civil Liberties, Due Process, and Our Constitutional Rule of Law. Professor Dershowitz, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer
on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, this dude, Dylan Mulvaney, who's become a bit of a celeb and a spokes being for big companies like Johnson & Johnson, social media influencer Dylan Mulvaney, this guy who goes around as a woman, was on Drew Barrymore's show. Yeah. Drew Barrymore has a show in the afternoon.
And you watched it? I'm shocked.
The clip
or somebody
made its
else
way,
watched it for you.
Yeah, the clip made its way around, and you know it was all about the put upon how the trans community is being marginalized and there's so much hate amid all the celebration. But okay, here's how that went.
Let me ask you about the negativity. How have you dealt with it? And what's an approach you take? What's your self-talk? What do you filter?
Yes.
How do you...
I still read the comments, but there is so much hatred directed at the trans community right now. It's everywhere. And I think the greatest weapon that I can contribute is trans joy and comedy and talking about hard, you know, subjects and really intricate moments of a transition and try to let everybody in to see
view.
That, you know, I'm not a monster. I'm not somebody that, you know, is trying to do anything but be myself. And be-
mm-hmm. Nobody says you're a monster and there's no hate. There's disagreement. And it's, of course, the left can't distinguish between those two those two descriptions. The identitarian left is incapable of it. And then close with a sentimental, barbaristic flourish.
Really just surrounding yourself with good people. It's interesting because I look at someone like you and I can't imagine anybody disliking you.
Oh, please. Do you know,
everyone
do you
want to
know, ironically, who dislikes me the most sometimes?
Who?
Myself.
Oh, me too.
Oh. And, but.
I get out.
Oh,
that is just, girls don't talk like that. That's just weird.
Drew Barrymore was on her knees, and then they did this.
She
embrace.
Was on her knees?
Yeah, she knelt down, then they were doing sitting Indian style, can I say that? And then they hugged it out. What a wonderful moment.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.